Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring the stories that make the incredible world of tech and venture tick. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to the founders, investors, and ecosystem operators trying to make a dent in the future. Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I'm super excited to have with me Jonathan Sun. Jonathan is founder of Horizon VC, a UK-based alt VC working to bring the convertible income share agreement, now known as a convertible future earnings agreement, to the UK. Prior to getting into VC, Jonathan was a former edtech founder, ran community events for Othership, Product Hunt, TechStars, and Guide Group, and also attended the Levin Entrepreneurship Program at the University of Washington. The program has students immersed for several years in entrepreneurship and allows them to build and collaborate whilst building relationships with entrepreneurs, founders, VCs, and angels. Jonathan, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you.
Thanks a bunch, man. Appreciate you having me on.
Excellent. So let's dive straight in. I'd really love to understand what the convertible income share agreement or the convertible future earnings agreement actually is. Why does it need to exist? And do you see this type of alt financing becoming more prevalent as founders become more educated on non-dilutive options?
You know, this is a great lead-in because actually I was just on a panel about this on Monday. So like it's really fresh in my mind. But basically, I think a problem that still plagues the UK today after all this time is the fact that of the lack of financing options beyond, you know, just blitzscale founders, right? And just basically, you know, unlike the US, I think the alt VC industry in the UK is like a few years behind the US. And so basically what that means is, you know, as a founder, you only have like currently as it stands, not including us, you only have a few options, right? If you're trying to build a blitzscale startup, you take a seed fast from, you know, any old angel investor, any old VC, right? And there's been a lot of debates as to, you know, whether or not they truly constitute pre-seed or early stage or not, just to due to, I think, reputations on, you know, how conservative they can be, right? Beyond that, you have Pipe and ClearBank for, you know, revenue-based financing, which are good for e-commerce businesses, but not much else. And then after that, you've got grants, Virgin Startup loans, and things like that. And so why we brought the convertible future earnings agreement to the UK is because we really wanted to give both the UK and EU an option for the truly idea stage to pre-seed area, right? We believe that there was a massive gap in this area. And to do this, we created this instrument to offset the risk of investing insanely early. So a future earnings agreement basically was originally created as a creative way to help students pay for university based off of their future earnings. Now, the way we've designed it is if a founder earns £2,500 or more in his or her business, then he or she pays 10% of his or her monthly income until he or she pays off 1.5 times in 5 years what we gave them, 2 times in 10 years, or if they raise a qualifying round of £700,000 or more, then the future earnings agreement gets suspended and whatever money left in the company gets converted to the lead investor's valuation at a 20% discount. Now, the future earnings agreement is secured to the founder. So if the business fails, then the founder still has to pay off the future earnings agreement via his or her full-time job, whatever comes next. And so because of the way I think we've secured it, you know, with that double-sided future earnings agreement and safe note, it's great for investors because that no matter what, investors are going to get some kind of return. And it's great for the founder because of the way we've designed it, we can not only go in much earlier for the founder, but also we don't have to pressure a founder to achieve those 10, 15, 20, 25x returns. We can instead allow the founder to, I think, be free to pursue whatever type of success he or she wants to pursue, whether it is, you know, bootstrap to exit, stable, profitable growth, that type of thing, you know, rather than, you know, force themselves, you know, to become, to balloon, kind of like, you know, when you see, you know, those American farm documentaries and, you know, they put GMOs inside of pigs and they balloon them to the size of, you know, like absolute trampolines, right? So that's kind of like the analogy that I like to use.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because apart from the analogy, which I think is definitely very interesting, I think, you know, in the UK, we've had instruments like revenue share agreements, which have traditionally or certainly more usually been used by impact kind of based lending. So people like Big Society Capital and sort of lenders of that nature, which are working with like social impact or, you know, businesses that have some sort of social enterprise angle to them. And as you said, I think, you know, in the USA, the ISA, the original kind of income share agreement was very much kind of a way to finance your way through education.
and certainly kind of higher education. But in the UK, to your point, like your options have really been get some debt, which is, as you say, the startup loan, which can be quite difficult. You know, not many young people necessarily understand how debt works and the fact that there are personal guarantees around it. Or you've got to find angels. Well, if you don't have rich people in your network, high net worths or access to these angel groups, which, like, to be fair, are becoming more and more open and it's easier to find that access. But I think outside of London, it's still very difficult. You know, if you don't have access to those types of investors and venture capital, you know, the more traditional venture capital kind of classes, then yeah, it's really difficult. And not everyone, to your point, wants to build a business that is, you know, is going to 10x year on year and like exit as a unicorn. And I think it's a really important thing that as an ecosystem, we do think about how we can create more opportunities for entrepreneurship and more opportunities for kind of sustainable growth, because sustainable growth also creates value and it creates jobs and it creates all sorts of other externalities, you know, positive externalities in the community. So I think it's great that you have a product out there, which, you know, is addressing a part of the crowd that up until now maybe has been a bit underserved. So this podcast is all about taking the plunge, right? We talk a lot about entrepreneurship and getting from zero to one, iterating from there. I'd love to learn from you and understand what your time on the Levin Entrepreneurship Program taught you about launching a product or business. And was anything that you wish now you had taken a risk on before? Like, is anything that you wish you had done that you hadn't?
Yeah, it was kind of cool because I think the program was kind of like my very first foray into really understanding what entrepreneurship was all about. So I think that was kind of like, I think my dream, you know, that was all the way, you know, back in my first year of uni, you know, my dream had always been to, you know, have my own. I think before I even got into VC, you know, my dream was to always, you know, build a business and, you know, exit at some point, right? You know, become a serial entrepreneur. And so that's kind of like what led me to, you know, check out Levin Entrepreneurship Program. It was kind of cool because, you know, I was real green, you know, that was kind of like when I was in the beginning stages of working on my EdTech startup idea, which is basically matching high school students to their best fit universities with unique sets of metrics. And yeah, that was the very first time I ever learned of things like, you know, user research, MVPs, you know, learning how to, you know, get, you know, save money, but, you know, getting people on Fiverr to help you do things, you know, learning how to pitch, get co-founders, you know, just a lot of basic things like that. Like, I remember walking in, like, pitching my business idea on the first day. And I thought that, like, everybody would, you know, would say, wow, your business idea is amazing. Mostly because, like, I think I had a little too many, you know, like, well-meaning people tell me I had a nice business idea because I guess they were my friend or my family, right? And then I got that big wake-up call when, like, one of the more senior members over there was just like, have you done user research? I was like, what's user research? He was like, go out and talk to 100 people and ask them if they really want that. And I was just like, oh, how do you do that? And so then I learned how to like put together type forms of like putting together surveys, which in retrospective, I figured my initial surveys were terrible because they were the sort of stuff that now I tell founders not to do. It's the sort of, you know, people hit a checkbox on the survey. Yes, I want this product. And you immediately equate that to like to product market fit. Look, 100 people of 101 said yes on my survey. I have a product that's going to guarantee you be successful. No, because they didn't give up skin in the game, which we'll talk about in prototyping later. So there's loads of wake up calls like that. And, you know, but I think I was only really active in the program for a year. And I think because one thing that kind of frustrated me towards, I think, the end of my first year and when I started really wrapping up work on my EdTech startup was like, I think there were a lot of entrepreneurs and there weren't a whole lot of entrepreneurs, if that makes sense to you. There were a whole lot of people that listened to Peter Thiel's podcast, Red Zero to One, you know, got obsessed with startup lingo and jargon and never really like took the plunge. And I was just like, I'm spending all my free time outside of school on this and you're not living that life. And so therefore you're not going to feel the vibes, man. You're not going to get it. So I think starting my second year, that's when I kind of moved away from a lot of like my university societies and actually just spent a lot of my free time outside of school, just plugging into the city startup ecosystem in general, just like, you know, from an EdTech standpoint, you know, networking, finding all the different, you know, EdTech, you know, groups and, you know, just finding ways to, you know, connect with, you know, different institutions, you know, share connections to, you know, high schools and things like that to, you know, on the more macro end, you know, attending things like Startup Coffee, you know, learning from the greatest ecosystem builders in the city, just gradually learning, I think, what it meant to, you know, foster a startup community ecosystem and bring people together to, you know, support each other and, you know, in the game of, you know, starting your own SaaS businesses and whatnot.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point, right? Because there is a lot of hype around getting into venture. Let's not talk about it as getting into entrepreneurship, because entrepreneurship could be everything from, you know, setting up a bakery to, you know, having your own kind of consulting business to, you know, to launching an e-commerce brand or launching, you know, a tech-driven product, right? So I think there are a lot of people that are probably entrepreneurs at heart, but they, you know, rather than satisfying themselves or settling for, you know, the first and most obvious thing, they kind of think that, oh, okay, what I have to do is go out and build that billion-dollar business a la Peter Thiel, a la 0 to 1. And therefore, that's the expectation that they can get from 0 to 1 really easily and that they could go to school and basically learn how to do that. I think that the really interesting thing, as you said there, is you can learn principles, but you have to put the principles into practice to actually learn, right? So you can learn all about what it means to do user research and get user feedback, but until you've done it and to your point, got it wrong, like sent out the wrong sort of form or not use the right type of kind of questioning mechanism, you haven't really learned, right? Like you only learn once you actually come across a challenge. Like the easiest thing in the world is to have no challenges. Like that's not where learning happens. Learning happens when you are challenged and when you have to, you know, when you have to actually go through some form of pain to move from one point to the other. And was there anything like that you wish you had done that you didn't take the risk on at that time? It sounds like you're a pretty entrepreneurial kind of person, so maybe risk taking was in your blood and you're pretty comfortable doing stuff. But was there ever anything that you're like, damn, I wish I'd, you know, going back, I wish I'd really taken a chance and done this? Or are you pretty comfortable with kind of how your journey has panned out from that perspective?
I mean, I think from a risk taking standpoint, like I've almost done pretty much everything that I ever wanted to do. I said that I was going to try to build a business in college, and I did. Even if I didn't exit the way I wanted to, like I did it. And, you know, subsequently, you know, from an ecosystem building standpoint, I think that was a yes and no in a sense, right? Because I think that when one of my friends, and he was like a major, I think back then he was like a big LinkedIn coach. And, you know, he went to Microsoft, became an AI product manager and was real passionate about startups. So I think when he moved over to Seattle, you know, we started, you know, hosting a lot of just random community events together. And so I think it was cool because like on that note, I got my foot in the door in terms of, you know, learning how to like ecosystem build on the side of, you know, doing all my other projects. I think something I probably wish I could have done a little bit more is maybe try to ecosystem build a little bit better at my university. I think just because spending a lot of time in the world, in kind of like the real world, meant that all I really treated university at was just a place to like, you know, hurry up, attend class, you know, pass my degree. And then outside of that, like I just basically lived life like kind of like a college dropout, except I did a little bit of homework every week, right? So I think it would have been nice to have gone back and done that. How, I'm not totally sure. Like, I think it's kind of cool, you know, just like watching, you know, some of like, you know, the kids, you know, up and coming younger than me, you know, build out scouting groups at the school, you know, build out, you know, little university accelerators, you know, just do a lot better job with the University of Washington startup ecosystem than I was ever able to do, even though I had all those ideas at that time. And so I guess you don't have time to do everything that you ever want to do per se. So.
Yeah, I think it's all right to forgive yourself when you don't do those things. But it is really interesting. I'm like this podcast and what we've got coming up as well, where, you know, we're in the process of launching a whole kind of content platform, is all about plugging into the ecosystem. You talk about plugging into the ecosystem. And I think that is the thing that is most important that people don't take advantage of. Like, I found it really interesting that it is not hard to go out and meet people. You and I met, I think, on a WhatsApp chat, and we, you know, we kind of had a couple of conversations, and here we are having, you know, recording this podcast. I think people underestimate how open and how willing to help people within the kind of early stage and growth tech ecosystem are, certainly here in the UK. I don't know if it's different in the States. And I know you just got back from Seattle. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Because I think you're from, if I'm not mistaken, you've lived in China, the UK, and in the US. Like, what are the differences in the ecosystem, the approach in those different places? Like, do you think there's a lot of similarity? Or do you think that, you know, at the end of the day, they are very, very different? You have to have a different mental model when you're working in any of those sort of places.
It kind of boils down to nuances in human behavior, honestly. I've never lived in China. I used to go to China a lot in the suburbs, but I never lived there. But I mean, I've been inundated enough with the culture. Me and my cousin's a tech entrepreneur down in Shenzhen. So I got a chance to attend one of his business meetings. So I'll break it down to you like this. We'll start off with China. I think China has a very big, so we have a term called Guangxi. Okay. And so Guangxi is a special term for a special type of relationship, mostly used in business. I think sometimes in personal life as well, where it's like social capital is kind of like the number one reason why you either get ahead or not get ahead in business. The way you build out social capital is a lot of wining and dining and a lot of, well, not even wining and dining. It's more like vodka and dining.
Well, it's baijiu, right? Like there's a lot of baijiu and a lot of guang. Like, I mean, we had this same conversation with Cleo Sham from ex-Uber, now with Stride VC. But yeah, I think people in the West certainly underestimate that kind of whole, you know, the amount of importance that those relationships and the strength of those relationships that people have, and why you have to cultivate those before you can even start thinking about doing business. But sorry, I interrupted you. But yeah, it is a very, very different landscape, I think.
It's crazy just watching my cousins and my uncle get engaged in that. You know, it was for the first time I saw that when I was like 19. They were like, all right, you're a man now, you can come watch, you know, all the random shit that we do, you know, with during our business meetings. So yeah, private rooms, they'll bring like all sorts of, you know, biggest sort of business associates, you know, expensive meals, which is wild because I mean, they're not rich, but like, I don't know where those expensive meals came from. So I just leave it to the other people to figure out, right? Yeah, a lot of baijiu. Of course, I'm not as great at drinking. So like, I had to, like, by the time I think I was on my second or third, I was just like, yo, please, like, don't cheers me anymore. I don't want any more of this. So they were nice enough and gave me like Tsingtao instead, which is a lot lighter. So yeah, it's kind of a mixed bag because I think I love how the Chinese are really warm. I think at the same time, like, wining and dining can be a very, very exhausting way to do business, not to mention how terrible it is for your health long term. Cigarettes too, loads and loads and loads of cigarettes, which turn your lungs into soft putty if people don't watch enough like medical shows. Now let's go over to US and UK, because I think the nuances between the two cultures I found were a little bit more surprising than like I thought, because I think in the UK it's interesting, because I think although British people on the outset aren't as outgoing as like Americans are on the outset generally. But what I do enjoy about the UK startup ecosystem is I think how to a degree, I think British founders, entrepreneurs, you know, even British people in business are more willing to, I think, take a personal approach than I think, you know, Americans in some ways, right? Like I like to put it down like this. It's easier to make friends in Britain, but it's easier to make small talk in America. And I have no idea why, to be honest. I can't sit there and give you the nuances of it. But all I remember is, you know, I've watched movies, you know, I've gotten drinks, I've gotten dinners with, you know, loads of, you know, British founders and, you know, VCs. And, you know, it's kind of cool, you know, having that culture out here. And America, it's been a lot of like, in America, it's very pure business, I think, in a lot of ways. And maybe some other people's experiences might be different. But like, I feel like, particularly, for example, you go to like, to a Zoom meeting in America, and it's like, you know, they don't even give you a whole lot of pleasantries. They just start it off with, okay, today we're going to talk about 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And in Britain, you do a lot of the 10 minutes of pleasantries and all that type of stuff, right? So it's kind of an interesting nuance there. I don't know if I answered all parts of the question, but I think that's probably the first bits I can think of.
No, I think you did. And I think it's really interesting what you just said there. And I made a note, right? So it's easier to make friends in the UK, but easier to make small talk in the US. And I think that actually resonates, because in the US, I think, to your point, people are much more direct, maybe a little bit more transactional, I guess, in those sort of relationships. There isn't time to be lost on the 10 minute chit chat, you know, 10 minute chit chat in before the meeting, that actually builds that relationship over time and allows you to create kind of more meaningful value over the longer term. Whereas, you know, in the UK, I think I certainly get very upset with people that try to sell me kind of straight off the bat, because it just feels like you've taken no interest in me or what I'm trying to do, and therefore you probably don't really have a great idea as to what you're even able to sell me, right? And I get pitched a lot of rubbish, let's face it. I think we all do now with LinkedIn emails and Lord knows what else. But, you know, moving on from kind of that conversation, I think it is really important to understand those cultural nuances across the board. But, you know, there is one thing that is fairly fundamental to startups, and that's, you know, get out, you know, get, as Steve Blank says, get out of the building, right? You talk a lot about prototyping, and I'd really like to understand from you what you think of as prototyping. What is that concept from your perspective, and why do you think it's so important?
Yeah, so prototyping is basically my favorite way to validate a business. I feel like actually, if I had to go back and answer one of those earlier questions, if I wish I learned something right out of the gate starting university, it would have been to like learn how to prototype just different business ideas. It's what I deem before prototyping, and it's essentially like the fastest and cheapest way to prove whether or not your business idea will succeed. And so the way we do that is you just run a series of experiments, and there's loads of ways to run those experiments. But the main objective of those experiments is, can you prove that your target market will give up something that's valuable to them in exchange for this hypothetical business idea? To a degree, I think a lot of founders kind of practice it, if not fully, because I see a lot of founders submit to me landing pages with the email address box. Now, skin in the game, like, you know, the email address, you know, it passes. But the trouble with something like an email address is I have 15 emails.
It's easy. It's ubiquitous, right? Like you said earlier, give up something valuable. Email addresses are no longer valuable, right? Like, I mean, that's a reality. If I can spin up another Gmail account, it's pretty easy, right?
Right, exactly. So I think in terms of skin in the game, I prefer probably phone numbers, time committed to demos, letter of intents, and pre-orders. So those are kind of like my four favorite types of skin in the game, which I don't see a whole lot of, mostly because I guess it is fairly challenging. Like say, for example, you've got an idea for edible dishwasher soap. And so you make a landing page saying the world's first edible dishwasher soap coming in like lemon, lime, and apple flavors. Would you like 60% off lifetime on this edible dishwasher soap? You can get it for £30 if you put in your credit card details here. Most of the time you're not, because people are very secure with their money. You know, they don't, people are very frugal nowadays. You know, people don't just hand out their credit card details like that. So it's almost like the ultimate form of, you know, business validation. And that's why it's the ultimate form of business validation. Most people will never give you their credit card details for anything on a landing page, right? So yeah, going back to prototyping, I think one of my big goals for Horizon VC is for more founders to validate, it's a more idea stage founders to validate their business ideas using prototyping. Because to be honest, like I've alluded to earlier, surveys don't really work. I mean, surveys work fine if you're trying to figure out like what problem you're trying to solve. There's a place and time for that, but not to show me that you've got traction. Like, so what if 1,000 people said yes on your survey? I mean, how many of those are blindfolded? You know, like how many of those like were just fooling around their cell phone waiting for the bus? You know, I'd like to have, you know, a gold chain that, you know, can spin around and, you know, tell me, you know, the condition of my heart, you know, at this minute. But am I going to give you £450 for it? No.
Yeah, I think in the age of easy to spin up landing pages using WordPress or using no code, capturing an email address, easy, getting a waiting list. I say this as someone who is yet to build a waiting list or has built a very small one, is very easy. But yeah, getting people to commit time, commit kind of their thoughts, their energy is very different. And, you know, you talk about 100 people. It doesn't even necessarily need to be 100. It can be 5. It can be 10. It can be 15. It can be 20, right? It is whatever it takes to give you the understanding that, okay, there is something of value here that people would probably pay money to use or buy from that, you know, from that perspective. And you could probably scale that up, right? Like if you can find 15, 20, 30 people with no product, when you have a product, hopefully you can find more if you have the capital to go out after them. So you kind of answered my next question to a small extent, right? Because I assume that as part of your criteria for investing at Horizon, you are looking at that kind of proof of concept and that the validation via the prototyping. But for you, what is most important? Is it the tech? Is it the talent? Is it the product? Is it that they have validated, or is it something else altogether?
So I have two separate sets of criteria, I think, for pre-seed and idea stage. And that's deliberate because it's kind of funny how many pre-seed founders think that they're idea stage and how many idea stage founders think they're pre-seed, right? I like to properly make a distinction between the two areas, because pre-seed to me is like somebody that's put about maybe a few months on their idea, built out some Figma cards, and, you know, maybe got themselves a co-founder and stuff like that. And when I think of idea stage, I think of somebody that woke up out of bed last week. Oh, I'm going to make edible dishwashing soap, and then I'm going to make a website to see if people want edible dishwashing soap. So for idea stage, the most important thing to me is the prototyping. And I think founder to me is really, really important, but I think there's always going to be inherent challenges, I think, when a founder in the beginning, unless you take the time to interview every single founder, it's sometimes a little challenging to say, oh, this founder shows unbelievable and outstanding qualities off of a simple Airtable line. And so you make a bet on the idea potential, and you make a bet that the founder has enough competent qualities, and you realize that nobody's a finished product. And so then you take that and you're like, all right, here's somebody that, you know, we all as a team, you know, can help out, you know, not only will we give them money, but we'll also give them support along their journey. And, you know, as long as I think they're bright, they're coachable, you know, they take their time to, you know, do stuff properly, and, you know, and they show flashes of, you know, being able to lead, have a culture and all of that stuff, then those are worth people worth taking a punt on. So I wish it was as easy. It was a lot easier to say, okay, if they have this, take them in. If they don't have this, you know, get them out. It's a lot of, like, I think as an investment committee, we kind of figure out, like, what ideas do we project to have potential? And then we take prototyping data combined with, like, all right, like, this is really different to the market, you know, how duplicable this is, network effects, all that type of stuff, which we all bring a unique sauce to, because we've essentially built out our entire team off of indie hackers rather than analysts from McKinsey.
Yep. Shout out to the analysts from McKinsey for sure. Indie hackers sound good. I mean, you talked about a couple of things that I think are really, really resonate. I mean, firstly, I've got to ask who hurt you in a prior life. I'm like, did someone actually try and sell you edible dishwashing soap, or is it something that you just use as an example? No, look, joking aside, like, one of the things I definitely look for, and as I kind of start my own investing journey a little bit, is coachability. And part of the reason for that for me is, you know, I've been around a while. I'm kind of in my mid 40s now. I've seen a few things, and I think founders that think that they have it all mapped out, unless they've, you know, done this a few times and they've got the war scars, I think need to have an element of, I wouldn't say even humility, but definitely kind of that openness to learning, to being coached, to having someone give them not necessarily guidance or direction even, because I think founders have to be decisive and have to be able to make their own decisions, but they also need to be the sort of people that can take on a variety of views and take a balanced approach to understanding those opinions and then making a decision, even if that decision is not what I have recommended. That's fine. The mere fact that you've decided to take the time to listen to what my opinion is, I think, is really important, because it, you know, it gives you more data effectively to make your decision. So I think what you said makes a lot of sense. Like, it is the founder, it is, you know, does the idea have scalable potential, and then so much of it is nuanced beyond that, which is really hard to kind of put down on paper or mathematically almost. So just as we kind of round off, what advice would you give founders trying to raise capital in the current market, especially given the seas of red that have been pouring through the public markets of late?
Well, first off, I think you gotta know which stage you're at, right? You know, make sure that you're getting the right types of capital for both the stage of business and the type of business that you're building. Obviously, if you're an idea stage founder, the very first thing I'm probably going to tell you is go through the exercise of prototyping and come play to us. No, not to be shameless out here, but I think, like, because I legitimately believe we're the only idea stage fund and the only idea stage investor that exists in the UK. Now, if you're in a pre-seed position, we are an option, but there are a lot of, I think, you know, angel investors out there. And to that, I think it is very important to know what kind of investors you're taking money from. I think that, I know, amongst a lot of circles, you know, I've been around, there are a lot of good angel investors that are around in London, and VCs as well. And then at the same time, I think there are a lot of, you know, angel investors and VCs that fit under, you know, the certain types of mentalities that frustrate us all, you know, from, like, bombarding your CAC to LTV for just £60,000, you know, to asking nonsense amounts of equity, to, I don't know, trying to squeeze in, you know, wild terms such as, you know, 3x liquidation preferences. And, you know, there's this other thing I learned a while back called a full ratchet, which, if you ever see the word full ratchet in your term sheet, never ever sign that. So yeah, I think it's huge for founders just to not get desperate. I think throughout the fundraising journey is two things: not get desperate, and then also, I think, be attentive to, you know, the kinds of relationships that you're building. I think, because although I'm big on cold intros, the tough reality is a lot of investors are not as keen on cold intros. So I think sometimes you kind of just have to play in an imperfect game and, you know, be able to, I think, try your best to, you know, thrive in that, even though the bulk of us, you know, are trying to, you know, do the best that we can to, you know, make the investing and fundraising environment, you know, for founders as great as it can be. But in the meantime, the environment's not perfect. People are not perfect. And I think you just have to try to not make excuses and just to do the very best that you can in all the areas I've listed above.
I think for a lot of founders, there is an element of, I don't know if it's shame, but, you know, there is this sort of stigma that they impose on themselves if they're not able to raise capital externally. I think we need to get away from vaunting raising capital as being the ends. It's not, it's the means, right? Like the end is building the great business, delivering the impact that you want to deliver. It's satisfying your customers. It's employing the people, and raising capital as a means to that. So I think it's really important what you said there, which is, unfortunately, as much as we would love for the game to be played on an even playing field, it's often not. It's something we've talked about quite a bit on this podcast at the end of the day. And as founders, we've all got to give ourselves, I think, the opportunity to sit back and think about, is this person the right person to bring onto my cap table? I've seen all sorts of crazy stuff with investors. I've seen investors that drip feed cash into a business every month, such that, you know, it's almost like the business is basically constrained rather than being capitalized, because ultimately it can't actually take any risks or make any kind of business decisions, because they are constantly having to kind of put their hand out and, you know, and ask for that cash. And the other thing that, you know, you mentioned there, you know, full ratchet term. So full ratchet is a term around anti-dilution rights. I won't go into the detail now, but Jonathan's absolutely right. If you're seeing that on your term sheet, then the likelihood is you're working with a VC that is trying to have their cake and eat it. But yeah, look, I mean, I think ultimately everything that you said there, Jonathan, is really sage advice. And I think I would echo what you said. There are not a lot of investors that are readily kind of available and, let's say, promote themselves as being idea stage investors. Certainly here in the UK, I think that kind of risk category has often been taken up either by the angel investors or the friends and family. You know, certainly SEIS and EIS kind of tax incentivization here in the UK has helped with that sort of stuff. Or as we talked about earlier, you know, it's the startup loans, which obviously hold their own kind of risk as well. So I definitely would suggest and recommend for any kind of idea stage founder that is looking to raise that initial bit of cash to get their idea off the ground, go and have a chat with Jonathan and the team at Horizon. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining me here today. It's been absolutely wonderful having you on the podcast. For our audience, where can they find you? Are you online? Are you on Twitter, LinkedIn? Where's the best place to look?
Whatever makes you comfortable. So my Twitter profile is capital J, lowercase O-N-A-T-H-A-N, capital Y, capital S-U-N, one. My LinkedIn is just my name. So you'll be able to see it on the podcast title. And hopefully it doesn't appear at number 20 on the list, because there's a lot of Chinese people with the same names. And my website is horizan.vc. And you can apply at the apply button.
Amazing. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a real pleasure having you.
Thanks a ton. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. Follow us on social and at nothingventure.tech to make sure you never miss another episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners to understand the topics and guests that they'd like to hear about and from most. Drop us a message via the links in the show notes, and thanks again for your support.